This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, everything we've been up to on Wednesday, the 29th of March. That includes going into new business relationships, including of the gas kind, between the UAE and Israel. We've had some expert intelligence on that this morning. Also, speaking to a Bitcoin expert about US regulators taking on Binance and CZ. And having a look at greenwashing, speaking to one whistleblower about what needs to happen in terms of regulation.
Should we talk, first of all, about these big Israeli stories doing the rounds at the moment? So many. You've got the UAE deal on Sunday signed with Benjamin Netanyahu. You've got this BP ADNOC deal signed yesterday, $2 billion, the UAE investing in Israeli natural gas. And of course, you've got the street protests in Israel at the moment. We're going to get the thoughts of one Israeli economist, Keren Uziel, of the Economist Intelligence Unit in about 10 or 15 minutes. But let's focus, first of all, on the UAE angle to this. I guess this story broke when you were on the flight back yesterday, was it? The BP ADNOC deal.
Yeah, and it's huge. I mean, this is a major international story, both because of the size of the companies that are involved. BP needs no introduction. Neither does ADNOC. NewMed Energy, you probably didn't know as well, out of Israel, but they're looking to take a majority stake, so more than 50% between them by the time the deal is done, to focus on gas development. It's just sizable.
Tom, you've been looking at some of the international reaction to this deal, haven't you? Three-way deal, Israel, Europe and the UAE.
Yeah, exactly that. ADNOC, as you mentioned earlier on, also BP getting involved in this one. And it is just yet more evidence, I suppose, if you need, of the growing links between the UAE and Israel. We've seen some customs laws amended over the course of the last few days, even driving licenses in the last couple of days as well. Yesterday, making it confirm that you can now drive under your UAE. If you're a UAE citizen with UAE driving license, you can drive in Israel and vice versa. Israeli tourists and citizens here in the region can use their driving licenses to drive here. How many countries have that rule at present? I know the UK driving license has that, but it's not a sort of blanket thing, is it?
I was just thinking, does anyone actually go and get an international driver's license anymore? I've done it before, where you go down and get the little passport and it's got your photo in it and it has a stamp on it. Are those still necessary?
I don't know. Producer Shruti has just said that she tends to get one to rent a car, yes. Potentially. The only driving license I've got now is my Dubai driving license. My European one has expired. And I've never, ever had an issue renting a car anywhere. And I rent cars. I mean, I go on holiday 3-4 times a year.
Except when you've lost your wallet or had it stolen or whatever.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. But I've never got to a country and they've said, oh, no, we don't accept the Dubai driving license. We need the international thing.
I've paid for them, but I've never shown it to anyone ever.
No, I wouldn't know how to get one. Wouldn't know if it's a thing.
Anyway,
Matt, Dubai One seems to do the job at the moment. Let us know your thoughts, your experiences with driving licenses. Staying with the Israel thing, the point that Tom was making was about the Israeli driving license is now valid in the UAE. So many different angles to the Israel-UAE economic story. We've been getting the thoughts of Khatija Haq, Chief Economist, Emirates NBD.
The UAE and Israel have signed a customs deal that would allow the free trade agreement that was negotiated last year to come into effect. So this will effectively remove tariffs on 96% of the goods traded between the two countries. And it also will help to boost bilateral trade, which last year reached more than $2.5 billion. ADNOC has also announced plans to buy an Israeli gas company in a joint venture with BP, which will give it access to gas reserves in the Mediterranean Sea. This is ADNOC's first major international acquisition, as it looks to boost its gas and clean energy business. And again, this will be a key driver of hydrocarbon sector growth over the medium term in the UAE.
Also been speaking to Khatija about the re-export plan here in the UAE. I mean, this could be a biggie. UAE already a massive re-export hub. They want to double Within 7 years, that's quite soon. By the end of the decade, the approval came at a meeting of the UAE cabinet. Here's Khatija's take.
The UAE has approved plans to boost international trade over the next decade, both in terms of re-exports, but also goods manufactured in the UAE or with a higher value added in the UAE before they are exported. So this is linked to the strategic plans announced last year to double the size of the manufacturing sector by 2031, and to, again, boost the share of manufacturing as a part of overall GDP.
Khatija Haque of Emirates NBD. Very quickly on economics, Tom, we've got a new comprehensive economic partnership deal being negotiated. None of us saw this one coming.
Costa Rica. They have begun talks, the UAE and Costa Rica, in this latest SEPA agreement.
What do we trade with Costa Rica?
Coffee.
Okay.
There's got to be a fruit in there somewhere.
Fruit. What are the largest exports of Costa Rica?
If only there was some kind of service that one could type it into.
Everyone's just typing into it at the moment. The links have been there for a while already. Non-oil trade between Emirates and Costa Rica grown by 19% annually in 2022. Emirates also investing in Costa Rican sectors such as IT, tourism, retail, advertising, media, real estate, renewable energy, air transport and logistics to strengthen its presence in the nation.
Name the two fruit that are amongst... OK, so the four top exports out of Costa Rica: electronic components, medical equipment, and two fruit. Name the fruit.
Bananas.
Boom.
And papaya.
Nope.
Well, it's not kiwi, is it?
No.
Oranges are not the only
tropical
fruit.
Tropical.
Pineapple.
Well done.
Totally tropical taste.
You could almost make an mbongo out of that, couldn't you?
That used to be a lilt, didn't it? But no longer. Nilt's no more. It's gone.
Right, rebrand, yeah?
Rebranded. What was it? It's become a tango, hasn't it? It's become a...
I thought it would become like orange coke or something.
Flavoured tango or something like that, yeah. A pineapple tango or something like that. But yeah, so we're all going on holiday to Costa Rica, basically, because we are... That one's in negotiation. Not been signed yet. Not been... signed, sealed or delivered as yet, but the negotiation starting yesterday.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Let's get some more detail on one of the big international stories at the moment, which is the protests taking place in Israel right now. Keren Uziel is an Israeli economist, senior analyst and country risk service manager at the Economist Intelligence Unit, covering the Middle East and Africa, joins us now live on the line from London. Keren, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
First of all, what have we learned over the past 24 hours about the latest situation in Israel with those judicial reforms and the protests that they have sparked and perhaps some knock-on impacts on the Israeli economy?
That's right. The crisis over the judicial reforms came to a head in the last few days. We've had 12 weeks of protests against the reforms, which would restrict the independence of the Supreme Court. And these came to a head when the Prime Minister, Mr. Netanyahu, fired his defense minister. And that led to a general strike, broader protests, and Mr. Netanyahu finally conceded and agreed to freeze the legislative process. And currently discussions are underway with the opposition about possible compromise. That has somewhat eased market tensions and helped stabilize market concerns about the potential impact of the reforms on the Israeli economy.
And yet we've had a number of deals done over the past few days between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. On Sunday, I know you were following this one closely, the two nations signed a customs cooperation agreement and Benjamin Netanyahu was there at the signing ceremony. And then yesterday we had this deal between the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, BP out of Europe, and a company that I must confess I'd never heard of, NewMed, an Israeli gas company, and it's a $2 billion deal. We'll drill down into the details in a second, but broadly speaking, what do you make of these deals between the UAE and Israel?
Clearly, UAE-Israel relations, particularly on the economic front, are still a priority for Israel. The Free Trade Accord came into effect has come into effect. It was signed last year, and it's very telling, right in the midst of the crisis that I was just talking about, that Mr. Netanyahu, who was there at the signing that brought the trade deal into effect. It's a comprehensive economic partnership agreement, so it'll cover pretty much all trade, bilateral trade between the two countries, as well as areas such as investment, trade and services, and so on. And this is the UAE's third trade agreement, the other two being with Indonesia and India, of course. So clearly a big priority. And the deal we're talking about is a joint venture between BP and ADNOC, who are keen to invest in the Eastern Mediterranean. And this is their first attempt to buy in. It's a $2 billion bid for a 50% stake in NewMed, which is an Israeli gas company that owns Israel's largest field, Leviathan.
Yeah, shares of NewMed yesterday gaining 37% in Tel Aviv after this deal was announced. Can you give us a bit of background and context, Karen, on the hydrocarbons in the Mediterranean? It's not something we have a huge amount of visibility on here in the UAE. We kind of know it's there. Is it gas? Is it oil? And where do we stand in terms of the territorial haggling over whether it's Israeli or Lebanese or Cypriot and so on?
There are still a number of outstanding disputes in the Eastern Mediterranean, Cyprus and Turkey as well. Israel and Lebanon have resolved their territorial dispute. The particular field we're talking about is not in the area under dispute. So Leviathan is Israel's largest gas field. Eastern Med is primarily a gas play. There's been a lot of growth in that area, not just Israel, but also Egypt, Cyprus in the last few years. The conflict in Ukraine and its effect on European gas supplies has really put Eastern Mediterranean gas, for obvious geographical reasons, at the forefront. And these newer suppliers have seen a real rise in demand and interest in their gas. Israel works very closely also with Egypt, a close UAE ally, in terms of processing their gas and so on. So there's a lot of opportunities there for international oil companies, and particularly for the UAE with its expertise in hydrocarbons, to invest and develop there.
Finally, Karen, just give us an overview of the Israeli economy over the next few years. Reading one of your reports, you're expecting growth to weaken this year as the global economy weakens, but then rebound to about 4% from next year. That's the most recent report of yours that I've read. How would you characterise the Israeli economy?
So the Israeli economy, one of its strong points is, despite the political turbulence that we see, both security and in terms of government instability, has been its institutions like courts and so on. If a compromise agreement holds, then the growth prospects will remain strong. It's a diversified economy, diversified markets, real strength in technology, and very resilient to global crises in the past. It had one of the fastest post-pandemic recoveries that we've seen. So when I say growth is going to cool this year, that's because it's been growing at warp speed the past couple of years, and that's not sustainable in the longer term. So overall, a robust economy, but facing some real headwinds, not just in terms of the global economy, but what's happening domestically.
Karen, great talking to you. Appreciate your time this morning. That's the voice of Karen Uziel. She's an economist with the Economist Intelligence Unit, covers Israel from her base in London, and has been doing so for many years. I know that because I used to work with her more than 20 years ago as an economist in London. Blimey, we've all got long memories, long CVs and LinkedIn profiles now.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
So some of the big names in business certainly making the headlines at the moment. We've had Jack Ma resurfacing over the course of the last 48 hours. There's also been a lot of focus on CZ. Why? Because news coming out in the last couple of days that US regulators are seeking to ban Binance, the world's largest crypto trading platform, alleging that the firm has been operating in the country, the United States, that is, illegally. CZ, obviously, the head of Binance, and no stranger to this part of the world. Binance is a brand and a name and a company that is well affiliated here in the region as well. I want to get a bit more take on this one. But before we do that, let's just hear from CZ. I mentioned that he's no stranger to this part of the world. In fact, this was him speaking in Abu Dhabi after the collapse of FTX the end of last year.
Yeah, so I think for the next little while, our priority is always on increasing transparency. So we're working on proof of reserves, just making it very transparent for the user to verify that their funds are there. And that's also the easiest way to avoid what happened to FTX. I think FTX converted user assets to do trading. So I think FTX is run more like an exchange ran by a hedge fund. The exchange is just the auxiliary part. It's really to facilitate the hedge fund for trading. Whereas we are the exchange. We don't have a hedge fund. So for us, the easiest way to avoid what happened to FTX is your user assets, just keep them as is. Just make sure that, you know, if the users deposit Bitcoin with you, just keep those Bitcoins for that user. That's it. There's no magic to it. We make money by charging a small fee, and we're profitable, so we're sustainable. So it's very simple. Like it's not like something really tricky, really difficult to do.
Changpeng Zhao there, CZ, speaking in Abu Dhabi at the end of last year. So he is very much in the crosshairs of the US regulators at the moment. Why? Let's find out and get more from the crypto lawyer. Partner in an international law firm, head of digital assets and blockchain, Irina Hiva, joining us live on the line and live on Zoom this morning. Irina, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you very much for having me. And yes, indeed, the operation chokehold on crypto continues in the US. Why is this happening? Well, they know better, right, what they're doing. But the good thing is that countries and jurisdictions such as positive to crypto, such as UAE, Switzerland, where I am right now, these are the countries that will benefit eventually because the companies are moving out of the US, are moving out of unfriendly jurisdiction. Last month, they tried to shut down crypto banks successfully. This month, they targeted the largest crypto exchange in the world, Binance. And Binance is an easy target, right? Because they're so big, they're so large, they're moving millions and millions of dollars in trade volume. So, of course, this action from CFTC is not something we did not expect. And the allegations are actually quite old. They're going back to 2019. And let's remember what happened in 2019. Nobody knew what they were doing. Regulators did not put out any regulations. So Binance and CZ were doing the best they could at the time they could. Some other interesting allegations in that civil claim is that Binance didn't have a head office. I mean, which digital company has a head office? So it just shows to us that regulators don't really fully understand the digital industry. They don't understand the crypto industry yet.
Like you were just saying there, certain geographies around the world are being more understanding, more welcoming of cryptocurrencies. US seems to have taken a different stance. Why?
US dollar is the reserve currency of the world, and it is my speculation that they're trying to protect it from alternative currencies such as Bitcoin, and they're trying their best to protect their currency from yuan and from other currencies. I mean, and of course, that's just my speculation. And, you know, when empires crumble, they take quite drastic steps, unfortunately.
Is this the CFTC flexing its muscles and simply that, or will we see CZ in the dock?
So this is a civil action, which means the results of the civil action is a fine. Several years ago, CFTC brought a civil action against exchange called BitMEX. They were established in Seychelles, but they were operating all over the world, including in the US. And the fine was $100 million. And $100 million for the largest crypto exchange is nothing, really. It's just a change. I mean, let's think back to JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs. When they actively manipulated metals markets, they made a $500 billion, but they paid a fine of $50 million. So if we consider the volumes, $100 million is really a change. However, what happened in the case of BitMEX, something serious happened. The founder, Arthur Hayes, actually received a criminal sentence of 2 years suspended, albeit, but still there was criminal actions that followed. So will we see Binance settling with CFTC? Yes, of course. The allegations are, again, back to 2019. CZ has came out, said how they cleaned up, and he's rejected half of the allegations. So there will be a civil fine at the end of the day. And of course, that's how the regulators work, right? They need civil fines to maintain their operations.
More charges brought against SBF from FTX overnight as well. Not great for crypto. But having said that, Irina, I've got 30 seconds remaining with you. 3 months into the year, what's the outlook look for crypto for the rest of 23?
Well, there is crypto, there's Bitcoin. Bitcoin will be a shining star, I have absolutely no doubt. And Bitcoin does not depend on SBF or FTX or CFTC or CZ or Binance or anything else. Bitcoin is Bitcoin. The rest of crypto, however, depends on the exchanges, depends on those big volumes coming in. So DCA into Bitcoin, consider friendly jurisdictions like UAE, and, you know, just keep your head down, work hard. It will all work out at the end.
Irina, I can't thank you enough for your time this morning. Thanks so much indeed for the update. Thanks also for getting up very early for us over there in Switzerland. Irina Hever, the crypto lawyer, partner in international law firm, head of digital assets and, of course, blockchain.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Size Business Breakfast.
We are talking greenwashing and whistleblowing now on the Business Breakfast. Talking ahead of COP about where we are with ESG investing and what needs to be put in place so that everyone is on the same page when it comes to sustainability claims. We're also going to look at what it really takes and costs to be a whistleblower, because we are joined by a woman who blew the whistle on her employer, the asset manager DWS, accusing them of ESG fund greenwashing. Now, DWS has repeatedly denied that it misled investors, but those allegations have led to investigations and many, many headlines around the world. Joined by Desiree Fixler, who is now Chair of Venture ESG, advisor to the UK's Financial Conduct Authority, and a consultant at the Emerging Market Financial Training. Thank you so much for joining us, Desiree.
Brandy, thank you for having me.
How does a group sustainability officer, which is what you were hired as by DWS in 2020, go from being executive to whistleblower?
That was a bumpy journey. It was tough. Look, the issue here was about corporate governance failure. Now, sometimes we forget there's a G in ESG. It is all about governance. That was my job. And when I noticed that there was a gap between what the company was publicly stating and what we were doing internally, I had to inform the CEO and the board. Misrepresentation, if it's material, could be considered securities fraud. We're globally regulated, and this was a major concern for me. And so, of course, I had to do my job. Governance was part of it, and inform management that we had a problem.
Now, DWS, as I said, has repeatedly denied misleading investors, and there are investigations and things that are ongoing at the moment. What I'm particularly interested in is the knock-on effects of whistleblowing for you. It cost you your job. What else has it cost you?
It did. It was pretty brutal. I was fired. I was thrown out of Germany. They pulled my visa. So I was made homeless, and I was publicly discredited. So it was very overwhelming. For me, what I had to do is I sought refuge in reading about other whistleblowers. For example, Gretchen Carlson, who took on Fox News. I read about Susan Fowler, who took on Uber. And of course, Tyler Schultz, who blew the whistle on Theranos. And what I realized through reading their stories is that there's a way to regain your truth, your narrative, reinvent yourself and come out the other side. But there's no doubt about it. It's tough.
Because you've now got what we'd probably call a portfolio career. I've read out three titles for you this morning. It all sounds very grand, advisor to the UK's Financial Conduct Authority, etc. But is the corporate world wary of you now?
I would say increasingly less so. Initially, absolutely. Everybody wanted to talk to me after the story broke, but no one wanted to hire me. And it's a shame. It's a shame that whistleblowing has a negative connotation. I did what I did in protection of the company. I did what I did to protect my colleagues. We needed to fix a problem. The whole idea of whistleblowing is to bring a company to a better place. And it really is a shame that there is, even it even persists today, though it's waning, there is a backlash against whistleblowers. But again, if you stay the course and you continue to tell your story, and again, what I did is I morphed, I embraced what got me fired and championed tackling greenwashing. And I just got myself, I put myself back into the mix, working with other companies to figure out how we can combat greenwashing because it is very dangerous.
Which is an excellent pivot into what needs to be done in a year where we're very conscious of ESG measures in the run-up to COP here in the UAE. Has the massive storm and media storm that you've been in had an effect on the industry when it comes to how companies report or talk about their sustainability claims?
Oh my goodness, it's been a game changer. I mean, it's certainly rippled through the financial industry. It created a huge wake-up call. And I actually praise the industry because I felt that company executives focused on the issue. They wanted to understand. Remember, sometimes greenwashing is unintentional. And again, what it's done is it's caused companies to reflect and to consider and do a firm-wide assessment and ensure that there's integrity to what they're publicly stating, to ensure companies are delivering on their pledges. And so I think that we've morphed into a period now where companies are a lot more cautious. They're a lot more considerate when they're making ESG claims. And that's what's most important. We have global issues that we need to tackle. We can't have companies, you know, lying about their sustainability activities. We need to know where everyone stands. And I do believe that it was important and necessary. We needed to pop this green bubble. And we needed this correction. There was too much euphoria and propaganda. ESG was considered previously as a PR tool, communication. And today it's about real corporate transformation.
Does regulation around the world go far enough?
Not yet, but I can assure you that the regulators are very focused on this. So what you see is the SEC are going through current climate risk proposals. The FCA has put out a great number of consultation and discussion papers with the industry, and so many other global regulators are also trying to tackle this. The whole thing is that we need to change our mentality. Previously, ESG was considered aspirational. You can kind of just say anything. In today's world, the sustainability office should be considered more risk management and compliance. And we need to be as accurate and evidence-based on our sustainability claims. They need to be overseen by compliance, and all reporting activities should go regular way through the CFO office. And I think this governance change is happening. Companies are now treading far more carefully and understanding they need to do what they say, what they publicly claim. They need to deliver on that.
Does a change, a generational change in consumer and investor affect this at all?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my goodness. I mean, that's why it's a top priority for all companies. Not only is it about risk management, figuring out how we navigate a very changing world because of climate change, amongst other changes, but also consumer preferences. Not only is, of course, climate change and the transition a risk for companies, it's also an opportunity. And of course, stakeholders want companies to move into this space, employees, customers, and of course, the regulator.
So you've said what you'd like to see happen on the regulation front. What would you like to see companies themselves do? For anyone driving to work this morning, we've got about just over a minute left with you. What can they start putting in place now?
It's all about governance, organizational structure. ESG isn't an island onto itself. It needs to be embedded throughout the organization. It should be considered risk management and compliance. And it's all about quality of disclosure. Just stay evidence, fact, and data-based here.
Desiree Flixler is the chair of Venture ESG. She's advisor to the UK's Financial Conduct Authority and a consultant at Emerging Market Financial Training. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.